I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to the Billboard Sharpie Podcast. Gary Truss, Billboard Senior Director of Charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
And with us this week,
Andrew Unterberger, Senior Editor on the digital side of Billboard.com.
Is it okay if we talk about me this week?
Always ready to talk about me.
What are you, leading Gary?
Yeah, no, very good. Very Toby Keith over there.
Not me. Me.
The song. Me exclamation mark.
We're going to be talking me, the song, Taylor Swift. First week really impacting the Hot 100 after it debuted last week at number 100 just based on airplay. So we will talk about the race for number one this week on the Hot 100. And we think it's the lead single from TS7, her seventh studio album. So we're going to look back. Best lead singles from albums over the last 25 years. Andrew, I know you're sort of the historian of 90s and O's around here. So
I appreciate that designation, Gary. Yeah. I didn't realize I was given that authority, but I'll happily take it.
So we'll get into all that. We'll start as always with this week's top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10.
Can we just talk? Can we just talk about where we're going before we get lost? Let me out first. Can't get what we know without falling. I've never felt like this before.
Number 9.
I'm the bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
Duh.
Number 8.
Look what you made me do. I'm with somebody new. Ooh, baby, baby, I'm dancing with a stranger.
Look what you made me do. I'm with somebody new. Ooh, baby, baby, I'm dancing with a stranger.
Number 7.
So you can take advantage of me. Tell me how's it feel sitting up there, feeling so high, but too far away to hold me.
Number 6.
I want it, I got it, I want it, I got it, I want it, I got it, I want it, I got it. If you like my hair, gee thanks, just bought it. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it.
Number 5.
Then you're left in the dust, unless I stuck by you. You're a sunflower, I think your love would be too much, or you'd be left.
Number 4.
I'm a sucker for you. Say the word and I'll go anywhere blindly. I'm a sucker for you. Yeah. Any road you take, you know that you'll find me. I'm a sucker for all the subliminal things no one knows about you. About you. About you. About you. And you're making the typical me break my typical rules. It's true. I'm a sucker for you.
Number 3.
It's a moment when I show up, God, I'm saying wow. 100 bands in my pocket, it's on me. Yeah, your grandma will probably know me. Get my bottles, these bottles are lonely. It's a moment when I
show up, God, I'm saying wow.
Number two.
I promise that you'll never find another like me. Like,
and number one.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached.
All right, that's the sound of the old town road galloping to a fifth week at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Lil Nas X featuring Billy Ray Cyrus. I mean, at this point, you know the story of how everything has gone down with the song. Huge in streaming, and once again, that is really what keeps it on top. 104 million streams, so it's starting to come back down. If you remember a few weeks ago, it set the all-time record at just under 143 million streams. So we're stepping back, getting a little closer to Earth each week, but obviously 100 million, still enormous, enormous numbers. So a long way to go, and Lil Nas is still riding clean at the top.
And hits the top 10 on the radio songs chart this week. So jumps from number 12 to number 6 in just its fourth week. That's actually the fastest jump into the top 10 of radio songs for a debut hit since Meghan Trainor.
Wow.
All About That Bass.
You guys are both fairly diligent radio listeners, if I remember correctly. Have you heard the song much on the radio?
I've heard it a couple times. I heard it this weekend. The tough thing about it is if I've heard the original version and I just heard the Billy Ray Cyrus remix, the original, you have like a minute and a half to hear.
Yeah.
So it's kind of
maybe that's I've been flipping around recently and I have not been able to catch it on top 40. I've not caught it on hip hop. All right. Well, good for Lil Nas X. I mean, we haven't heard many of the streaming, you know, the kind of the classic streaming hip hop hits really take off on radio like this, to this kind of velocity. So, I'm glad to see it's getting that kind of embrace.
You guys know what happened in the Kentucky Derby, right?
I know that the winner was disqualified. For reasons I don't quite understand due to my lack of depth of horse racing knowledge.
I just want to say thank you to the Kentucky Derby, because now Billboard has the second most controversial decision place a horse in 2019.
Did you see that, that Lil Nas X himself tweeted a joke to that effect?
It was just a quote tweet about somebody's article about what happened at the Derby, and he said, "I know how you feel, maximum security." And so...
Never misses an opportunity, that Lil Nas X. He's
still
a master marketer.
I mean, years from now, I'm sure we'll still be on the receiving end of a lot of those punches.
Number one on the Hot 100 for a fifth week. And yeah, the big battle was Old Town Road going to stay number one, or was Taylor Swift Me going to jump, become the first song ever to go from number 100 to number one? So debuted last week just from airplay, and this week sales and streaming factored in for the first time. And it wasn't entirely close. It was a race, but comfortably ahead for Old Town Road, finishes at number one. So sales were huge for Taylor Swift, 193,000 for the week. That's the biggest for any song since she sold 353,000 in 2017 with Look What You Made Me Do. Here's kind of where the difference is. Look What You Made Me Do started with 84 million streams. Me starts with just about 50 million. So kind of a drop-off, kind of noticeable drop-off, as huge as the sales.
Kind of a drop-off?
That's a pretty noticeable drop-off. And kind of wondering what way we should really look at this, looking at the numbers that the song had on the Hot 100. Me would have been number one in all but five of the 19 weeks so far this year. So part of it is timing. It winds up stuck behind Old Town Road, which is just such a huge hit, is the narrative that is number two and just – not a number one, or is it that it ran into Old Town Road? And again, how much of it is a surprise, Andrew? Do you think that that the streaming was really a lot less than Look What You Made Me Do?
Yeah, I mean, well, we were joking about it in one of the meetings, I think late last week, about, oh, well, you know, underdogs, you know, scrappy underdog Taylor Swift doesn't stand a chance against a juggernaut like Lil Nas X, which is pretty funny to think about at this point. You know, obviously Taylor Swift, one of the most celebrated and successful Hot 100 artists of the last – well, certainly over the last 10 years. And, you know, this song, I think it had a couple things working against it. It does sound more like a song designed for radio than one for streaming. You know, it doesn't really have that kind of 2019, you know, sort of hip hop inflected post genre sensibilities. Feels like a big pop song, a big pop rock song, if anything, really, and actually feels more in line sonically with what her collaborator Brendan Urie of Panic at the Disco has been doing the last few years, and actually having success on radio equivalent to any of the really big Taylor Swift singles from that period. So it seems like that was the direction she kind of went with it, is to eventually hit one of those sort of top 40 saturation pop songs that, you know, just is unavoidable on radio for the next 6 months. And, you know, she seems like she's off to a pretty good start there, and we'll see where it goes from there. But also, you know, when you compare the numbers to Look What You Made Me Do, I think it was almost bound to pale in comparison, just because the curiosity around Look What You Made Me Do. I mean, we've talked about this before, but really comparable with only a handful of songs that I can remember of this decade. And just in terms of like, oh my God, what is she going to do next? Because 1989 was such a gigantic success, and the controversy between her and Kanye and Kim Kardashian, and then the whole Snapchat gate had added such a narrative wrench to her career. But yet, you know, she still was on this level that only a handful of pop stars this decade have been at. And so everyone was just kind of curious how she was going to respond. And she had done a total media blackout that had lasted years, maybe. Yeah. So at least it felt like years at the time. And so it just felt like, man, like what is she going to do when she gets back? And then, you know, you saw the title, you saw the social media stuff with the snakes, you heard rumors about, you know, her working in more of a hip hop direction. And it was like, oh, you really couldn't guess where this was going. And it was very obviously going to be the biggest story of the year, minus perhaps the fact that it was going up against Despacito for the all-time Hot 100 record. But this new song, you know, it's like 18 months after Look What You Made Me Do, something like that. Maybe more than that, but not the full 2 years and change. Or
yeah, I wonder if that's even throwing people off.
It feels soon, right? It does. Yeah. I mean, because Delicate lasted for a pretty long time into 2018, and obviously the Reputation tour was such a big story, and the success that was, that felt like we were talking about it until the end of the year. It feels like we're barely even done wrapping the cycle on Reputation. And now it's time to just kind of start the machine over again. So I think all of that goes into this maybe not being so much. It doesn't feel like the anticipation is as breathless as it was with Look What You Made Me Do, because it's Taylor Swift and because, you know, she plays the game better than anybody else too. Like, there obviously was going to be a big response to it. And look, going from 100 to 2 in a big week, that's never been done before. You know, that's impressive in its own right. But the fact that it wasn't a number one, it's understandable.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point about the narrative, I mean, Taylor Swift, for better or worse, or whether she wants to admit it or not or realize it, has always benefited from narrative. There's always something about the comeback, whether it was her first pop album and Shake It Off. You know, what's that going to be like? Look What You Made Me Do obviously had the built-in narrative of everything that had happened in the Kim Kanye gate, everyone turning against her. You know, she's the outcast, and how she strikes back. This song doesn't have that same kind of weight to it in any sort of way, and I think it's almost kind of interesting that she went on ABC like hours before the song came out, and the song wasn't sort of just the event itself was the song. It sort of felt like it had to be drummed up a little, like, hey, I'm back, I'm going to do some interviews, I'm going to really go back into regular press mode. I know a lot of people who also, the song throws them off in a way that's very... You know, I mean, it's a very fun song. It's sort of, I guess, I'd say you've put Cotton Candy on a record. That's kind of what this sounds like. But for some people, it's Taylor Swift's about to be 30 years old. It's a song that is sort of, I don't know, for someone's seventh album feels a little like not, maybe this is a first album kind of debut song, get out there. It seems, I think for some people, that's what felt weird about it to mm-hmm. them was it almost was just the bridge doesn't, you know, is it the spelling is fun. Yeah. Bridge is very like weird for, I don't know, a 30-year-old to be doing. And that's kind of maybe a weird critique to have. But whatever people are out there thinking is, you know, that's sort of valid in itself. To me, it sounds like I think of it more as a song that was maybe meant for like a soundtrack or something. I think that's where it would have fit in better. Because to me, in a way, I think this could have a good life actually on adult contemporary radio. I think it's a song that's fun enough for kids, fun enough for moms who are driving around needing something on the radio for their kids who would get into it. So it kind of has that younger demographic and it hits that older one, but it's just that middle ground that I think is
is lost by this.
Right. Yeah. But in terms of the quality of the song and how it correlates to maybe feeling more like a soundtrack single, and I've heard two. I think I agree first off that it's not my favorite Taylor Swift lead single, certainly, but I think there's two interesting sort of counter arguments in defense of it. One is that the lead single for Taylor Swift album is historically kind of misleading in terms of what it pretends for the album to come. Shake It Off was a little brassier and less, 80s inflected than the rest of 1989 was. Look What You Made Me Do was a little darker and synthier and more hip hop inflected than the rest of Reputation was. You don't necessarily get the full Taylor album from its lead single in any event. And I was talking to one of our freelance writers here today at Billboard, who's actually a very big fan of Me, the song. And he says, look, there's a lot of darkness on the radio right now. There's a lot of gloom. There's a lot of pouting. There's a lot of sullenness and there's heavy introspection and heavier productions. And is there anything really wrong with a little frivolity for balance? And I think that's a fair point.
Well, I mean, she made it very actively that was what her narrative was. She wanted to go after that. Was she wanted, she was saying to Robin Roberts at ABC that, we have the ability to get melodies stuck in people's heads. And why not use that opportunity and that platform to get something fun and bouncy and catchy and enjoyable? If something has to be stuck in your head, why make it, so awful and negative? So it is it's a conscious effort to sort of shift, if you want to say, the entire pop landscape into something a little more optimistic. Can Taylor Swift do that? As mighty and powerful as Taylor Swift is, can she single-handedly do that?
Well, at the same time, number one on the radio songs chart in the top 40 is Sucker by Jonas Brothers.
Sure.
It's the year of Ava Max. So maybe this really is.
the year of Ava Max. As it will be forever remembered, yes.
But it could be some sort of – we had a lot of the SoundCloud rap last year and just the natural cycle of things.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for that. I mean, I was definitely very curious going into this single whether or not she would – whether she would sort of try to follow more in the lead of an Ariana Grande or a Billie Eilish and kind of respond to what they're doing and maybe kind of counter with her own thing. And I was sort of thinking it didn't occur to me this would be the way that she would do it in terms of going so dramatically in the pro pop direction. Not that those other people aren't making pop too, they are, but in more of the kind of conventional sort of the big machine pop and everything that represents. So it's interesting to me that this is sort of her entree back into the pop world of 2019, which is already even very different than she last left it in 2017. I don't know if this is going to go down as one of her all time greats, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of response radio has to it. If her initial plans and sort of setting radio in her sights and saying okay, we're gonna do something unignorable here, if that pays off with a song that's as popular as High Hopes was. We'll see.
Let's also not forget that this, nothing's in a vacuum. So I mean that in the sense that for so long, so much of Taylor Swift's singles were allegedly about certain people who had done her wrong and this and that. And it seems like even just from the few magazine pieces that she's done this year for LUK and everything, she seems to be in a very good place in her life. Mm-hmm. Steady boyfriend for a couple of years now, at least. There's not nearly as much drama or controversy. Obviously, the Kim Kanye thing is, hard to believe that was... Well, coming up over almost 3 years, 3.5-ish years ago.
Feels a lot longer ago than that at this point, yeah.
But if so there's not sort of that same kind of intrigue and narrative, and maybe she doesn't have that perspective to write about. And also, talking about Taylor trying to sort of shift people's mindsets and what's going on in the world, let's not forget that this is, really her first release since she became much more politically active, if you want to call it that, on social media, obviously coming out for some of the Democratic candidates. So I think for somebody to sort of try and project that message of, hey, let's get out and vote, let's support these people, and then to turn around and do something, kind of, what do you want to call it, mysterious or downtrodden or, sad or, moody on as her next song might be a sort of mixed message about, okay, we were all, about rallying together 6 months ago and now we just gave up on that? Or so in a way it really does kind of continue, for better or worse, a narrative that she's started in the past 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, you look at I'm just thinking career wise too, about a dozen years in now to her career. Where were other big acts at the time, and not just to pit pop stars against each other, but that's kind of like where Madonna was in the mid-90s, but a dozen years in, Mariah in the early 2000s, and some similarities where they'd still put stuff out, and it would be an event, maybe not an automatic number one, but still huge hits on the Hot 100. So kind of seems like you're in that upper level of superstars where if we're talking a dozen years in and it's still, is this going to be number one? Still a huge hit. That's a level that few people actually get to.
Like, yeah, we're talking about a number two hit. and I guess I think about that just in terms of, you know, I mean, a few, I guess maybe years ago at this point, we were all, you know, I mean, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry. I mean, they weren't coming close to, you know, Miley Cyrus even, you know, scratching top 10. And the fact that Taylor is automatically a number two and we're all like, whoa, is this the end? You know, is this?
It's a very good chart week for pretty close to literally anybody else on the planet.
Right.
Yeah. It's just people who've been out, you know, came out after her have fallen apart faster than she has. So like, and all things considered, I mean, we're talking about a number two hit, worst case, which still very possibly could go number one.
And I mean, it should probably be said that, you know, I mentioned Delicate earlier, like that probably goes down as the longest lasting hit off of Reputation. Oh, yeah. And I can't remember what it peaked at, but it wasn't anywhere close to number one. But
it was number 12.
Number 12, yeah.
Slow build.
But that's probably going to go down as kind of a signature song for this period. So, you know, the number one, you know, it's obviously nice to get it. It makes for a nice kind of, you know, something for the sticker for the CD, so to speak.
I like you mentioning the sticker on the CD.
Oh, well.
Good old
dating myself
sticker.
A little bit there. But, you know, It doesn't have to be a number one to be an important part of her discography. And I think the true test for that is still to come.
And weirdly, the number one from that album
is not
going to age, you know, in any degree.
Were you obsessed with stickers on CDs and tapes years ago, Andrew?
No, I was obsessed with how annoying they were to scratch off when I was trying to open my CDs and, you know, just get to the liner notes and the actual.
But they were on plastic. You'd keep.
Yeah, but some of them were. But there are also those ones that were kind of on the top of the binding.
Yeah,
and those.
Well, especially if you didn't buy them, like if they weren't shrunk wrap, like if you bought them like at a used store or something like that, they would be there.
And if they had like the little pull tab, and you're supposed to be able to just pull it right off, but you can't do it. I mean, I guess that's not like the official sticker, I guess. But you know, this is now like very in the weeds of the jewel case industry. But yeah, they would have that little part on the top of the CD case
where
that
it was,
would
like
have
the name
title.
And the title.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be able to just kind of pull it right off, but it always took like, you know, you maybe got half it off the first try and then you're like scraping with your fingernails trying to get the rest off.
Yeah. But this was the sticker where it would mention like four songs. Like,
yeah, no.
Eight Grammy nominations, including
– But it would mention – whatever. It would usually mention the first single first and then three. Yeah. And to me, it was always, wow, these are going to be the four singles in that order.
Okay,
it was always
kind
of, is that really it? And then why wasn't this one a single?
Did you like keep a collection of these stickers? You seem very – Okay, Gary's giving this smile, by the way, that you can't see, but he very much did. He did.
I might have a bag.
Wow,
somewhere,
Gary.
Carefully clipped plastic.
No, I did like, you know, when they would have the critics' quotes or the star ratings on them, and I felt definitely like personally hardened once I became a music writer and I first saw my first byline on one of those stickers.
Who was it?
That was pretty cool. There's an emo artist named Jeff Rosenstock. Appreciate you, you giving me the big ups there.
All right, I guess we'll go back to chart stuff.
Sure, yeah, let's talk about charts.
Talking about number two hits, yeah, The Problem, Ariana Grande, first single back in 2014. Before that, Get Lucky, Daft Punk, number two hit, felt maybe bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. Room 5. Can we give some credit to Pharrell Williams for that record? Goodness.
Yeah. Maroon 5, Payphone, I think a lot of people would be surprised that was a number two hit, and One More Night was a 9-week number one.
Payphone was what, the first single since Moves Like Jagger, so it kind of got that. And it had that random Wiz Khalifa feature.
Just sort of end of the last decade into the start of this one. Before that, too, I don't know if this is maybe on the same level, but was a number two hit. And for a while, it was his biggest hit, Boyfriend by Bieber.
Sure.
I guess one other thing, too, that maybe makes it look like, say only number two, but because she's had previous number ones from the previous three albums. So once you get on that streak, it becomes expected that you're going to be number one. Mm-hmm. So when you don't continue that, and I guess maybe it's a little safer to mention this now because Justice 4, but kind of like when Loverboy by Mariah in 2001 ended her streak of first singles going to number one. It's kind of all you can compare it to are previous number ones, if we only knew years later.
Nowhere to go but down from there, certainly.
Yeah, Justice for Glitter. But still, yeah, number two is still huge.
Well, and some of the there was one Taylor fan account this week that really got onto that. They were saying – said a week from now, Taylor will become the first artist to have four consecutive number ones from four albums since Mariah in the 90s. So they were all like they knew what they were going for.
The history speaks for itself there, certainly. Although still historic for Taylor, biggest single week jump in Hot 100 history. And that's going to be a tough one to break. Let me tell you, there's only one other single that can do it, you know?
Yeah. All-time number two hit for me feels like a number one. Dancing in the Dark.
Yes. That's a good one. No, I think Blocked by When Doves Cry, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
When Doves Cry deserved. Sorry.
Well, they could have shared. I'm sure When Doves Cry had a number. Yeah.
No,
one was beating Prince in 1984, so that's fair enough. But that's certainly an all-time classic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, so talking about number two hits, let's go back through the archives a little bit. So, just looking at some of the biggest first singles from albums over the last 25 years. Not so much debut hits, although if we think that fits with what we're talking about, sure. But just more along the lines of how Taylor Swift coming back again with what we think is the lead single from a new album. When an artist comes back, and sometimes they just hit that magic of just the right first song to come back, and it maybe is just the right mix of trends at the time or narrative or we've been talking about, or maybe they work with a writer or producer who's just so over the moment, and it just creates a huge hit. So
and momentum too. So many. I feel like so many big comeback hits just really play off what the last album did in a lot of ways, which is not a knock, but just to show that, you know, you were so massive that it can carry over years later, and people are like ready for that next one.
Can either do that or you can throw a complete curve. Mm-hmm. Those are usually the two choices. I'll start, Trevor, with that exact style you're talking about. I'll kick us off in summer 1994. It was the return of Boyz II Men with I'll Make Love to You. They made their name pretty much with ballads, and they came out with a 14-week number one and then followed that up with On Bended Knee. But they showed that
ballads
sometimes...
Ballads on ballads on ballads.
Yeah, and that second album sometimes, it can be either the sophomore slump or it's the one that fully solidifies your brand. I think that song did.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, there was nothing bigger than Boyz II Men on the entire planet. That that song was massive.
That must be your Philadelphia speaking.
Well, I don't know how it exactly reflected locally, but it certainly, if you looked at the charts, you would have thought the same thing, wouldn't you?
There's nothing bigger than Boyz II Men. And the whole time you were growing up,
when I was first starting to listen to popular music on the radio and watching MTV, Boyz II Men were the standard. Okay, I don't know what to tell you. It was them and Mariah Carey. So I mean, it made sense that they ended up linking up.
All right, if we're going to stay in that era, I'll mention Mariah Fantasy,
yep.
because Dream Lovers before our 25-year cutoff, but also Fantasy just continued.
So no matter what song she'd have put out, would have made the cut.
It's a huge hit. It showed her evolution that just continued with every single pretty much throughout the mid-90s, where she just kept going a little bit more hip-hop, and I feel like Fantasy was much more progressive for that than Dream Lover was. Dream Lover is still much more of a pop song. This one really showed, okay, she really is interested in adding hip-hop.
Yeah, I mean, I love Dream Lover, but Fantasy is, I would say, if you had to kind of define Mariah Carey's 90s in one song, I think Fantasy is the song. I think that's the one that's aged the best. I think it's the one that's probably most recognizable to pop fans, and it's got an iconic video and an iconic remix. It's that's about as good as lead singles get.
And I think you could say that Honey continue things further, but in some ways she kind of set what the model was with Fantasy, and Honey maybe just didn't have that same surprise element. 3 week number one, but
there's certainly no the success of Honey was hardly a consolation prize. I mean, that was still a massive single, and as was Heartbreaker from Rainbow after that. And I was writing about Mariah's use of samples for the magazine recently, and it occurred to me just how explicit the blueprint was that Fantasy set, that then Honey and and Heartbreaker set off the next two albums, or you take a lead single, you find some kind of semi-obscure sample from the early 80s, and you build a kind of hip-hop inflected song around it, and it's radio gold, and it worked three times out of three for Mariah.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you brought up Dreamlover earlier, Gary, because to me, Fantasy is like the... Like, I don't know, something like it's the accessible version of Dreamlover. My only problem with Music Box is, I mean, I think it's a great album, but to me, it's almost a little too polished. Like, it's a little too, like, we're going to make, like, the most wide appeal pop star there are. And something about Fantasy was just, like...
It's a little edgy.
I mean, it's in that same kind of mold, like, and, I mean, without, I don't think it's hip-hop at all without, I mean, the remix element obviously is, but... Fantasy, even by itself as the regular pop song, is just there's something that's just so I don't know. I mean, whether it's the bass of the sample, I mean, even the shoo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doos, like it's just the most effortless, fun song to sing. And yeah, I mean, I think to Andrew's point, for sure, it's certainly one of her best songs in her entire career. Probably does some of the 90s in a way that's she's still pop, but she's fun, but she's willing to try some new things. She's got samples. So everything that you like about Mariah Carey is in that one song. And I mean, I remember the scene in Rush Hour with little girls in the backseat. that was probably the first time I'd ever heard that song. And it took me years to actually figure out what that song was. And once I did, I was like, yo, this is like, I mean, everything in the little bridge breakdown, it's just perfect.
Feels like we were talking about this recently. What a great year for pop. 1999 was I Want It That Way. Perfect for a single, Backstreet Boys. But Andrew, I'm guessing that's on your list of mid to late 90s.
It's one of the great pop singles of our era. It's one of the great, you know, if you're designing a single for a second album, you want to kick it off with a song that kind of does what you were already doing well and just kind of perfects the formula and takes it to new heights. Yeah, it's I Want It That Way. There's no question.
All right, what else you got from mid late 90s?
All right, well, I don't think we mentioned Notorious B.I.G.'s Hypnotize. Kind of a sad story, as it turns out, because you know, obviously, you know, I think this song was just sort of starting to bubble up. I don't think it had been officially released, but he had started kind of testing it out in the clubs, and you know, he died. He was gunned down in early 1997 before the song could kind of really reach its maximum impact. But you know, even if there hadn't been this tragic story and sort of a national outpouring of grief and affection for Notorious B.I.G., I think it still would have taken his career to that next level because it was just an undeniable song. Has you know, Hot 100 DNA baked into it with the sample of Herb Alpert's Rise, one of the greatest choruses in hip hop history, certainly. I think borrowed from Slick Rick, and just an undeniable video, just fun and immediately accessible, and actually kind of pretty dark if you listen to some of the lyrics on that second verse. But just the kind of song that, you know, plays once and immediately the whole room understands what's going on, and kind of has endured pretty well to this day. And I'll set another one, and that's by Trevor's fave, Janet Jackson, Got Till It's Gone, which might not have even been an official single. I know there's going to be a little bit of an asterisk there because I don't think it was ever commercially released as a single. Certainly the first video off that album, it was the first song that fans heard from it. Not, you know, coming off of Janet period, her probably, you know, her most successful album to date in terms of Hot 100 hits, or one of them anyway. I mean, she had so many, but coming off like just the massive success of that album, and That's the Way Love Goes, and Again, and all the big videos off of it, she kind of took a back seat. She didn't come back with a, you know, she didn't copy the formula the way that Mariah did for the first single off of Butterfly. She went deeper with it. She kind of had the new soul thing going on. She had the ad-libs from Q-Tip and the production, I think, from J Dilla, and that Joni Mitchell sample going on in the background.
Turned out to be a big hit for Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, no, and Joni Mitchell says that, like, you know, kids started coming up to her on the street going, "Joni Mitchell never lies." Yeah. And it was an about face for her, but It was also sort of like a course correction. It was like, okay, I don't need to have every single of mine go to number one. It's okay if this one's just kind of an airplay hit, a groover, a song that kind of makes gentle inroads on MTV, but doesn't necessarily announce my presence with authority. It's just a song for the fans. And then she comes back with Together Again, right. And that's the massive hit, and that's the one that she still has to perform at every live show. And then that's the one that people who aren't necessarily huge Janet fans remember from the Velvet Rope. But God Till It's Gone was just as good, I thought.
And then in 2001, she kind of went back to the formula, and I guess really for the last time on that big commercial level with All For You, sure, and Someone to Call My Lover, she just went right back. Let me make pop songs for everybody.
You got Fantasy. Okay, let's. All right, where to start? I'll start with. I'll kind of counter Andrew's Hypnotize. I actually, and I guess if you want to call it a double-sided single, whatever. Mm. I'm going. Of the two songs on that single, I'm going to say California Love by Tupac, I think is a fantastic single to this day. If nothing else, because, I mean, it kind of actually got to the Diddy playbook a little sooner than Diddy. I mean, just took that old sample, reworked. I mean, this is Dr. Dre really doing the production work back here, taking that old sample from an old Zap song, reworking it into this giant anthem. And so many of the G-Funk songs kind of had that. You know, they were big hits, well liked, but they kind of had that laid back feel where you're kind of, you know, a little more mellow, but more sort of more musicianship behind it. This one was just dedicated to be a hit. I mean, the whole chorus was shake it, you know, while everyone's just up there. I feel like you just can't not party when that song comes up. Dr. Dre, I think, has one of the best opening verses of any rap song all time. I mean, even though it's a Tupac song, I feel like really Dre should get at least half the credit for making that such a massive, massive hit.
And often doesn't get his due as a rapper. People are like, oh, he's a producer and he happens to rap too. But yeah, I agree with you. It's one of the great verses of the 90s.
I had Fantasy on my list, so I'm glad Gary brought that up too.
Same.
I'm going to give a shout to...
Everyone falls in love sometimes.
I guess no surprise. I was going through the list of number ones and I feel like I have to call out Exhale. If nothing else.
Oh, we're going first single off a soundtrack.
What?
Okay. All right.
First single off? Way to get Whitney.
It's
in
an album.
Somehow.
Only because I keep thinking about this. Like, to me, Exhale is probably one of the best in her catalog, if only because it was something that was finally different. Like the vocal performance on it is a lot more rich, I guess. Like for so long we know Whitney Houston sort of power belter, you know, it would follow that same kind of formula, the I Will Always Love You's, the I Have Nothing's, and then we almost have it all. And Exhale is the first time it kind of like we kind of tone it down and we get a lot more interesting layers to her voice. She really only kind of hits one sort of belt note, and that's really in the bridge. But to me, there's something that's just like, okay, you know, you can impress us with the power and the range and all that thing, but there's something nice about, you know, maybe if you didn't realize how much intimacy, you know, Whitney could bring to her voice. Also want to shout it out because I guess if you want to think of Waiting to Exhale as a concept album, because really every song on that soundtrack is by an African-American woman, great R&B singers, past, present. I just think that's a neat milestone in a way that probably no other project had brought such a... One, I mean, a talented group. If you look at who's who on that soundtrack, from TLC to Aretha to Patti, Whitney, of course, CeCe Winans bringing in gospel, Brandy is on there. I mean, just so many people. Toni Braxton. See, Toni Braxton was what, seventh? I didn't even get to mention her. Like, and so it's just like just to have that array of people. It's probably something that honestly, like, I don't know if it's just the way that the industry is now, or the way that, you know, people make up feuds or whatever. I mean, can you imagine trying to get, you know, to get that many great talents of this generation together on one project? Like,
it was the Lil Dicky Earth of its time.
It was the Little Dicky Earth.
I'm sure exactly what Trevor was thinking.
Into the 2000s, and the song was number one on the Hot 100 at the end of the 90s and into the 2000s. It was Smooth by Santana. So when you have Clive Davis figuring out how to, it's not so much a comeback, it's almost his, to a lot of people, I'm sure younger people, really didn't know much about Santana. So
a rebirth.
Yeah. into later in 2000, I'll mention Madonna Music, because now it feels, doesn't feel that groundbreaking, but at the time it was a really different sound for her to be doing, and coming off the softer sounds of Ray Light with Frozen back in 1998. And sort of like this year, we've been talking about the cowboy imagery that Madonna was doing, that with the cowboy hat. There was a lot of talk about that album. And again, even at that point, about 16 years into her career, there was a lot of, she was still really commanding the conversation.
And still her final number one to date on the Hot 100, right?
No, don't remind her.
Yeah. No, well, to date, you know, plenty of time left in the game on that one. But music's a great call. And I guess I can't remember where we were cutting off this this range of years, but Hung Up off Confessions on the Dance Floor.
Yeah.
That certainly is another one of those lead singles that just kind of reminds people what Madonna's good at and what she's always been good at, and has sort of entered her canon as one of the all-time classics.
2003 and 2004, because I think they're pretty just definitive of the entire era. And the really songs that they were by artists who were obviously established, but I think these are the ones that took them just to the level that made them stars they ultimately became. Crazy in Love by Beyonce, and Yeah by Usher.
For someone who has as many classic singles as Beyonce does, I feel like not a lot of them have been lead singles. You know, you're talking about Deja Vu, If I Were a Boy, Best Thing I Never Had. Or I'm sorry, it wasn't even Best Thing I Never Had. It was Run the World, right?
Yeah. Run the World was the first single off Four.
So, I mean, those are, you know, maybe they're good songs. Maybe they're not some of her best. But I don't think any of them really enter into to the all-time discussion with her. I think if you're considering Formation as one of her lead singles, which I think technically you might do that, that's probably, you know, in the Beyonce canon. But it's sort of an anomaly. Her lead singles have been kind of historically hit or miss.
All right, what else you got from early 2000s?
So, you know, I think there's a little controversy as to which came first when it comes to Outkast, Hey Ya, versus The Way You Move off Speaker Box, The Love Below. But go back an album, Stankonia, first single, Miss Jackson. Certainly that was the song that blew them up to an entire new universe. First number one on the Hot 100. You know, they'd had some crossover success before, Rosa Parks, Elevators, you know, never quite making the top 10. Then Miss Jackson just comes out with that chorus that, you know, everybody's singing back the first time they hear it. And that put them on the map as pop stars, not just rap stars or Southern rap stars. And from there, the decade was pretty much theirs.
All right, so for going 2000s, just at the cusp of the 2000s, you mentioned, Gary, Backstreet Boys, got to give it to NSYNC with Bye Bye Bye.
Bye, 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 bye.
First single from No Strings Attached. I mean, just once you hear it, it's instantly playing in your head. And I think probably no single move since maybe like the disco pointing finger has been so like quickly associated with the song, a little like, you know, a little bye 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 wave that everybody was doing. And I think everybody kind of does it in the wrong part sometimes when they do it on the high school dance floors or whatever. I'm gonna let it go. But I mean, just to have that iconic move alone, you know, suggests that this song somehow still amazed it was not a number one hit on the Hot 100. But it feels like culturally, it feels like it was definitely a number one. It just feels like it was the biggest song of the time. From, you know, Backstreet Boys were big, but it felt like NSYNC somehow eclipsed them, even just in terms of their peak popularity. And yeah, I mean, all this time later, you can still play this song anywhere, and everyone just knows what to do. They just get NSYNC. It's crazy. They get NSYNC. Wow. Okay. I didn't even plan that. It's that they're that good. They're that infectious. Other than that, gonna soundtrack it again. Gotta give it to Lose Yourself, Eminem.
Yeah.
I mean, what? I mean, just if anything, and you want to talk about Andrew's, you know, big on sort of the context and narrative surrounding it. I mean, who would have guessed in 2002 that Eminem had a song like this in him? Everyone, you know, he was so outlandish and polarizing, and whether he was cartoonish or whether he was being a ghoul or whether he was really saying some of the most, you know, like demonic sort of, you know, terrible things that were going to happen to people in his family. And then to turn around and put out this entirely huge positive anthem about going out there, getting what you want the minute you have the chance to do it. Don't let anybody stop you. And there was nothing, you know, tongue in cheek about it. Or sorry, I mean, it was 100% genuine. And I just think that, you know, in itself, like, you know, in a way, I think that probably endeared it a lot of people to Eminem in a way that they maybe thought they never could be or would never, they would like him and think he's funny or, you know, crazy, but they would never sort of be emotionally attached to him. And, you know, in terms of the context of what this song did, you know, the first song to win, first rap song to win the best Oscar Academy Award, be up for Song of the Year at the Grammys. So just those cultural milestones that he helped knock down too. I mean, just still after all this time, one of those songs, The Hook, what are we, 17 years later, still one of the best for sure.
And Eminem, you talk about one of the all-time runs of lead singles. You go from My Name Is to The Real Slim Shady to Without Me. And then if you're going to count it as his, then Lose Yourself. That's four that we could be talking about just as easily in this discussion. Then you get to number five and it's Just Lose It. And maybe that explains why the reception of that song was so tepid, because it just wasn't on the level of those other four songs. But yeah, everyone that just kind of built on what he had done before and the discussion around him. And no one ever said, like, I mean, literally on some of the songs, nobody ever said, like, I'm back the way Eminem did. And so he was, I think he understood the power of a lead single the way that few pop stars in the century have.
All right. Going through the rest of the decade, I'll mention two of them are really that the idea of really putting something out there that is maybe going to confuse people and really could be a total miss, but they both worked. Mentioning NSYNC, Trevor, Justin Timberlake, Sexy Back. There was a lot of talk at the time of what is this? What he made a mistake. Why did he come back with something just so strange? Why would he ruin the momentum he'd built up? Maybe for some people, for me, it took a few listens to figure out what this was. And he brought Sexy back to number one.
Yeah, he did. It was a little bit of a left turn. It felt more dramatic at the time than it kind of feels in retrospect. But it was a song that just kind of, it really built on the fact that he was such a big star on the last album, and there were things that he could do with a sort of confidence that not a lot of other artists in his lane could. And so he could say something like, I'm bringing Sexy back, and it wouldn't seem laughable. It would just be like, okay, this is the new catchphrase. And then I remember, like, at the VMAs that year, Al Gore was saying it, and like it got to a point where it's like, where it seemed like, okay, this guy is the guy who's currently dictating the terms of pop culture. And didn't necessarily last much longer than that, but that was certainly one of the all-time great pop returns.
We've seen this a lot when you come out of a boy band. There's always that tendency, well, I got to do something that's way much more adult. I got to show that I've grown up and I can do something a little less bubblegum. So he did that. It totally worked. Going on to 2007, total different way to do it. Just come back with a song that hits people right over the head with a hook. So Rihanna was obviously established at that point with SOS and Ponte Replay before that, but it kind of feels like this is the song that brought Rihanna to just complete mainstream audience. This was adult contemporary radio. But, oh, we have a song we can now play by Rihanna. This was just pop culture inescapable.
There's only one, I mean, one line seals that whole thing. And who can do the Ella, 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 A-A-A better than Rihanna? Just like, that to me is also one of those things where Just the uniqueness of Rihanna's voice in terms of sort of that tone and that sort of, it's not a gritty voice, but it's like, it's such a unique vocal that's one of those things that just seals the deal on that song, is nobody can sing that post-chorus like Rihanna. And yeah, I mean, because first when I heard this, I was like, Umbrella, what an odd title. What's this going to be? How, you know, is it going to be corny or whatever? And yeah, I mean, the metaphor is a little, you know, maybe it's a little too obvious or whatever, but it's something about the way Rihanna sings it that just like sells it. And this is one of those songs that pretty famously had been kind of passed around for a while. Britney Spears was, I think, probably the closest artist who was going to record it before Rihanna, ended up passing on it. And so it just falls into Rihanna's lap. And then you're absolutely right. I mean, it just takes her to an absolutely next level, that she's obviously still very much writing a role. Well, that she's obviously only continued to grow from and has never really looked back. But yeah, just what a great track.
Yeah, I think she's been lucky to have two of the great lead singles of all time in her career. And I'm lucky. I'm sure she had more than something to do with herself. But yeah. between this and We Found Love.
Yeah.
Just two five-star immediate smashes, immediate all-timers.
We Found Love. I gotta play this back again.
It definitely maybe outstayed its welcome a little bit. I mean, when any song lasts that much for that long, it kind of has to a certain extent.
I think it still sounds great.
I think it still sounds great, too. But
I'll play it tonight and let y'all know, because
I think now that you're not hearing it five times a day for a year, you'll be able to appreciate it maybe a little bit better.
Gotta get dip, boom, boom, boom. Gotta get dip, boom, boom, boom.
Also, in 2009, Boom Boom Pop kind of reminded me of Sexy Back, in the sense that I Got a Feeling would have been the total safe first single choice, but gotta give credit to artists who decide to really throw a curve, and in this case, it worked. They wound up at number one between the two songs for a record 26 straight weeks.
And end up setting the table for the entire EDM era, the Black Eyed Peas. Who would have guessed in 1999 that the people to bring back electronic music to the mainstream would have been Will I Am and Taboo and them?
I'll throw out a critical favorite, or at least one that the Grammys were big fans of. I'm going Dixie Chicks, Not Ready to Make Nice. Because, I mean, whoa, you are talking about a narrative surrounding the song. I mean, no song probably, just so black and white painted what actually happened to them. Somehow you don't know with what Natalie said about President George W. Bush, which of course is so funny to think nowadays that would be, you know, a headline for 5 minutes on CNN and we'd all move on with our lives. But to face that so publicly and to, you know... not only acknowledge it, but then to stay defiant in terms of all of that. And part of that, of course, was that public opinion had shifted in the years between the comment and when the song came out. But I think just the fact they were willing to come back and their first single consciously make a stand.
It was so meta in a time when society wasn't quite like that, like it is now. Stood out a little bit at the time for being
To be that
self-referential,
right? Exactly. I mean, even down to the parts where specifically, you know, the mom tells the kid, it's a sad story when a mother will teach her daughter to hate a perfect stranger, was a specific incident that they referenced. And yeah, I mean, you know, to put that back in the face of everybody, and then famously, of course, when they win one of the Grammys, you know, Natalie gives the haha to show that they won. That in a fun way, and I guess in a weird way, that was kind of the Dixie Chicks swan song, is that everybody sort of, we acknowledge them back in our good graces and you can all exit the stage quietly. I kind of hate that's sort of how it wrapped for them. They never really got back on country radio or got that same sort of mainstream success again. But at least to have that moment where, you know, the famous video where they're throwing paint on each other and to get on to SNL, and they were just at least for a moment, okay, we can all heal from this and, you know, carry on.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating pop stories of the last 20 years to me, because, like you say, it was both this triumphant comeback and this basically, you know, ending of everything. Like, it was their biggest pop hit on the Hot 100, but country radio didn't touch it. None of the singles after that really went anywhere to the same extent. And when you compare the sales for Fly and for Wide Open Spaces to Take It the Long Way, it's a different galaxy. It's a difference between going platinum and going diamond. It's both this redemptive, triumphant comeback and this moment of really kind of sad humbling for them.
And even in, you know, I mean, I'm talking almost a decade later when they're back at CMAs with Beyonce doing that. I mean, they got a lot of, you know, they got a lot of eyebrows.
The controversy never ends.
It's interesting that, yeah, I mean, a decade later, they were still sort of the bad girls, the outlaws, they were just stained in a way that they're never going to be clean again. And maybe in, I don't know, 20, 30 years when they're sort of legacy artists and it's time for lifetime achievement honors or sort of those kind of reevaluations.
I saw a inducted Dixie Chicks into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame movement building on Twitter the other day.
I mean, it's got to be.
They've got the rock and roll archetype.
It's got to be pretty close to their 25. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how society looks back at the Dixie Chicks and whether we forgive or we just try to forget or whatnot. But absolutely right that to go from being the country darlings to just, you know, thrown out of the whole ceremony is so tragic.
Tragic, ironic. Yeah.
I'll tie that into the 2010s. Dan Wilson co-wrote Not Ready to Make Nice, collaborated with Adele on 21. Rolling the Deep? Is there any way to take a momentum of a first album and then just multiply it almost exponentially to the point where Adele became Adele with Rolling in the Deep? It was a good year, 2011, for acts coming back with first singles. Lady Gaga, Born This Way.
Talk about, you know, Adele and building on what she had going on 19. I mean, to me, it was like a different galaxy altogether. Like, I registered 19. I actually hadn't, I didn't listen to the album at the time. I listened to it much, much later in life. But, you know, I knew Chasing Pavements. I maybe had heard Hometown Glory, one or two other songs. To me, she was like one of those VH1 You Ought to Know artists. You know, okay,
she literally was.
She was, yeah,
every morning, but, you know, I remember.
Yeah, like I didn't necessarily think of her as being that far removed from Duffy, for instance. And then she came back with,
she was like a club, like a club singer, like an intimate kind of, like,
yeah, but I just didn't know her story that well at the time. But for me, she was like a one hit wonder. Okay, maybe she'll come back and she'll get some VH1 play, some adult contemporary play. But the idea of Adele as one of the decade defining pop stars never even crossed my mind, and it still is kind of mind blowing to me that that's how it went down, and that she ended up putting up sales numbers the likes of which we might never see again. And it's a testament to Rolling in the Deep, the song, and it's a testament to the strength of 21 as an album, and it's one of the stories of the decade for sure.
And I think that's what makes Hello maybe more impressive in some ways, that she could,
she kept it rolling.
How do you follow up Rolling in the Deep, and to do that with the song that even spent more time at number one and was such a huge pop culture, it maybe bigger overall.
I'm not going to give you bigger overall.
At least when it first came out.
When it first came out, just because like that was the song that everybody was talking about because it was so highly anticipated and because it mostly lived up to expectations. I think in terms of the overall impact pop culturally, Rolling in the Deep, just I don't know if there's ever going to be matching that. Like that song lasted forever. I mean, I was working at a pop music blog at the time, and every week, without fail, there was some story we had to write up. So and so covers Rolling in the Deep.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like it.
One other wild mention is from this decade, and it's maybe not so much the impact of the first single, but more especially because the singles all kind of came pretty close time wise. What Do You Mean, Justin Bieber?
Yeah, I mean, What Do You Mean was definitely on my list too. Although I did wonder if we were going to get into a discussion about whether it should have been Where Are You Now versus What Do You Mean, because Where Are You Now did come out earlier and it did end up on purpose. But yeah. I think most people kind of view that almost as like a bonus track on that album. It did seem like, because it also was on the Jack U album first. So yeah, it did feel like What Do You Mean was the proper lead single. And man, I was working at Spin at the time, and you know, it was a staff of six, and then we were all kind of in one crowded room, and there weren't a lot of songs that we could all agree on. That was like the one song we could all agree on, and everybody loved that song. Though it's funny, like you don't really hear it as much anymore. It seems like it's kind of been overshadowed since by Sorry, yeah, and by Love Yourself, and maybe even by, you know, Despacito and I'm the One. But it feels like that song has almost gotten lost to the sands of time a little bit. It might take like a good TV sync in 5 years or something to remind people what a great pop song that was. But it certainly was.
I do think Where Are You Now put him back on the map in a way that made sure that he wasn't going to flop. Yeah. It was a different direction, a different lane, different artist, different sound. And I think, and that was, you know, by no means a guaranteed hit. I don't know if it had the same machinery behind it that the later Purpose singles
would have.
It felt
like a surprise release at the time, almost. Like it felt like he was kind of testing the waters with it. Like it did not feel like the big machine was behind that song. The people took to it.
More
and
of
so
an accidental.
Blew up. Yeah, an accidental hit.
I mean, just it's like one of those, you know, you could see almost like a Khaled album where you have plenty of tracks with guest stars. You just pluck one out and it suddenly becomes this thing. And I know people who, you know, I know people who were very much like, oh, I hate Justin Bieber, but oh, I like that song. Like, oh, that song is good. So I think that, I mean, that to me, probably the most important song the Bieber's ever put out, because that really redefined him.
I agree with that.
Yeah. What Do You Mean is, I got lost in the shuffle. And I think maybe it's, even though it was actually a long lasting hit, even though it was only a number one for 1 week. Yeah. There's something about Sorry and Love Yourself that really did eclipse it. I think that's probably right. I think those are probably actually better songs than What Do You Mean?
I don't know about that, but okay.
Do you? Oh.
Well, it's close. There was nothing but winners off that album. So, no, I mean, we went off to split hairs there.
Yeah. Because, I mean, yes, it's a fun summary song, but I guess there's more depth to Sorry and Love Yourself.
And that was a little more self-referential as well. Sorry kind of felt like that was really him kind of apologizing for some of his missteps.
Yeah, if you want to talk about narrative and hidden meanings, and I mean both Sorry and Love Yourself, mm-hmm. and even What Do You Mean, you know, has some veiled references to certain individuals who do exist in this world. But yeah, but I mean, in terms of importance of what that set him up for for sure. You know, that makes the list in that way.
I think it's just to take it to something really current. I would put maybe the most recent song that really fits this. Thank You Next.
Yeah.
Ariana.
Sure. No, I mean, and it's funny because I wasn't even really thinking of that as a lead single at the time when it came out. It was like, it was, you know,
like
4 months after Sweetener, not even, like it was barely even, you know, I think there were a lot of people probably who thought that was just the latest single off of Sweetener who weren't super clued into the Ariana discussion. I mean, it was so immediate after. And like, I mean, it was so immediate that pop radio was still playing Breathin' and even No Tears Left to Cry and God Is a Woman to a certain extent, because those singles hadn't yet had their entire shelf lives exhausted. And she drops this other song on a Saturday night and she's rewriting the rules of pop music, and it was her biggest hit to date. And yeah, I think it's absolutely the defining single to end this discussion with.
All right. That's this week's Billboard Sharpie podcast. We'll see what's going on the Hot 100 next week. We'll see where Taylor Me is in its second week. You would think sales and streams would have the typical second week fall off, but airplay is going to keep building. And again, the way Old Town Road is going, it would seem to be a pretty safe bet to keep going. New Shawn Mendes song, If I Can't Have You, will debut somewhere.
Eminem and Logic probably in there too,
yeah.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, that Logic song.
All right. So we'll wrap with New Shawn Mendes to finish off the podcast here. Also, just chart news. If you missed it on Billboard.com this week, there's a new chart coming later this year. The Global 100. It's going to be a companion chart to the Hot 100 that measures global streaming and sales from around 180 countries. So it's always kind of been a somewhere between a dream and a goal to have a chart that could measure consumption in different countries. But there's a lot of growth happening with Nielsen Music, the way they're able to track that. So later this year, a new 100 chart, the Global 100, on the way. Before then, Shawn Mendes next week on the Billboard Hot 100. Take this out.
That I hate to admit it, but everything means nothing if I can't have you. I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without thinking about you. Is it too late to tell you that everything means nothing if I can't have you?
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited-edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.